You're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you have a question about your animal's behavior, give us a call right now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. In addition to the calls, we have another special topic to share. Right, Patricia?
We do. You know, we've all seen those beautiful tropical fish in aquariums and pet stores. Some people own them themselves. But it turns out that some of those fish are ending up out of the tank and into the ocean. Ooh. Today, we're going to talk about why this is a problem for many ecosystems.
And we'll also talk with author Temple Grandin about how she uses the mysteries of autism to understand animal behavior. But before we get to that, we have some callers waiting to speak to us. And let's go to our phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi.
Hello. Who are we speaking with?
You're speaking with Gay Gaines in Palm Beach, Florida.
Gay, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
My husband and I have a wonderful 3-year-old mutt, part collie, part lab, and everything about her is perfect except that she kisses us too much. If you're sitting in a chair, she's licking your feet or she's licking your hand. And when we come home from a trip, it's all lick, lick, lick. And we appreciate a few kisses, but not so many. And we'd like to have her just lie beside us without licking us.
Oh, you know, I had the same problem myself. As a matter of fact, a couple years ago, I got a dog named Lassie, who I've now had for, 11 and a half years. And Larry has met Lassie, and Larry can tell you that she has an active tongue.
She does, but she's a wonderful dog.
She's a very sweet dog. It sounds like your dog is very sweet, too.
Annie is so sweet, and she's very well-behaved. She's well-trained.
Well,
it's
good
just
girl.
The licking.
Well, it's a high-quality problem, but I can understand how it's a problem. It's a little damp sometimes, doesn't it? Here are two things you can try.
Okay.
One is give her something else to do with her mouth. So get her, whenever you think she's going to be sort of in her kissy-kissy mode, you're sitting on the couch and she comes up and she starts licking, get her in the habit of going on cue so you can say, go to your toy, of licking a toy. You can get those stuffed hollow toys that I talk about a lot. Smear a little bit of food inside, and she can lick and lick and lick.
To her heart's content.
To her heart's content. So basically you're saying, don't lick on me. You can lick on that.
That's a great idea. And put a little food inside it.
Smear it. Don't make her sick with a half a cup of peanut butter or something. Just smear enough food that she'll lick it out. And dogs who are really licky will often lick and lick until the last molecule is gone. But there's also a second thing you can do that I do with Lassie a lot. I do with all my dogs, as a matter of fact. It's relatively easy to teach. The word I use is enough, just enough. And that means that's enough.
That's it.
that was nice, but that was enough. And the way you teach it is you say enough in a voice that's sort of a statement, enough, a little low, not harsh in any way. And then pat them on the head. Pat, 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 pat. Let your hand just sort of bounce off the top of their head. And most of
them hate that.
They hate that.
They do?
That's right. But many of us pat our dogs that way, but if you actually look at the dog's face, they're like,
yeah.
And then dogs who like your Annie, who are so sweet, are probably going to be like, well, I didn't like that, but I love her so much, I'm still not going to leave. So then you get up and you just walk, I call it a body block, you just walk towards them and just sort of scooch them with your body. You know, they move, you move towards them and then they move right, so you move right and just back them up a little bit. Don't say a word, very gently, very quietly, and then sit down, fold your arms and look away like Jack Benny. And do that maybe 2-3 times in a row. An amazing number of dogs get it. They're like, oh, okay, she's done interacting with me. I have to go entertain myself. So try those.
And they know not to lick anymore.
Well, they'll go.
Eventually.
They'll go do something else. You know, you're saying, I don't want to interact with you anymore.
Fabulous.
Yeah, so try those two things, and I think you'll be just fine.
And thank you very much for calling. Here's the number for you to call if you'd like to join in, 1-800-462-7413. You know, Patricia, we received an email from Missy in Anchorage, Alaska, and she says, I have a 5-year-old cat, and I recently moved her into a new home with a new dog. And in addition to the new move, we recently installed a ceiling fan in the bedroom. She's petrified of the fan.
Oh, the cat.
Yeah, I've gotten her to relax when the fan is turned off, but the minute you turn it on, she goes crazy. How do I help her get over this?
Oh, honey.
That's too bad.
Poor baby. I have heard of both dogs and cats and I think a bird being terrified of ceiling fans.
Oh.
Reminds me, I was doing a herding dog trial competition for sheep herding dogs. A lot of pressure, you know, big deal, a lot of pressure. And I'm walking with Cool Hand Luke, my trusty Luke dog, up to the post, and I'm just nervous as heck. And there was a windmill that Luke happened to notice overhead as we walked, and he took one look, and his eyes got like pancakes. So we both walk up to the post, absolute wrecks. So it's a similar kind of a thing. They don't understand, what is that huge monster spinning above my head? Fans, windmills, same kind of problem. Here's what I do with your kitty is, first of all, if at all possible, do not have her on in the room for a while during your conditioning sessions when you actually need to use the fan. So if you need the fan on, just put her out, because I don't want her under the bed sort of hiding from it, because that's just going to keep up her sort of habit of being fearful. What you want to do is, since she's okay with the fan off now, first of all, you're going to determine her absolute favorite food in the entire world.
Okay.
So it needs to be the best. It's a fresh piece of cooked turkey. It's, you know, it's really great stuff. You're going to show that to her, let her see it, but don't have it. Then you're going to flick the switch for the fan so that it moves 2 feet, you know, like
okay,
half a revolution, slowly. But then you're going to turn it off, and then you're going to give her the piece of turkey. And you're going to do that 25 times in a row. And then the next session, you're going to turn the fan on for an entire second, mm-hmm, rather than a half a second. And you're going to gradually work your way up. I think you're best off to I just call it zigzagging, for want of a better term. So if it's half a second, 1 second, 2 seconds, then 1 second, then 2 seconds, then 3 seconds, then 5 seconds, then 2 seconds. So you're going to have sessions that sort of bounce up and down, where you're not always increasing how long the fan is on. But that's the idea. The trick with this, as I've said many a time, with this kind of a counter conditioning, that's what it's called, you're doing counter classical conditioning, is it takes, you need to spend a lot of time in the early stages. So spend weeks on a second, two seconds, until she can get comfortable at higher durations.
And, you know, sometimes with a fan, too, there's that sound, that
and, you know, that's a really good point. That's a good point, Larry. One thing to experiment with might be to see if it, usually it's visual.
Yeah.
And that's why I focused on that. But, you know, it's always possible that there's a little kitty who didn't, the kitties don't read the books anyway, mm-hmm, not any of them, you know. The border collies do, but the kitties don't. So you might want to experiment and see if she can't see anything, if it's just the sound. And in that case, basically you're going to do the same thing either way, Larry.
Yeah, so it's the same difference.
The other thing I do is I would get the plug-in feel-away.
Oh, yeah.
That feel-good pheromone that you can't smell, that tends, in some cases, to relax animals, you just plug it in, put it in the bedroom where the fan is, see if that helps some too.
All right. Some good tips there. And if you have a question and would like to email it, what's our email address?
Oh, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to call, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Dale from South Haven, Mississippi. How are you today?
Well, just great, Dale. Thank you so much for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have the cutest puppy in the world, without a doubt. I've never seen one any cuter. It's a 9-week-old jackrat, and it's part Jack Russell and part rat terrier.
Oh, cute. I'll bet it is very cute.
Yeah, she is. She's wonderful. Her name is Zelda, and this is our first experience with a puppy of this type, and just a couple of questions about her. I really need to know the best way to kennel train her.
Sure.
And also potty train her.
You bet.
Without terrorizing her.
Yeah, and good for you for not wanting to scare her. And you know what? So often what happens when people use punishment to house train a puppy is they teach the puppy, don't ever go in front of me. So you'll take the puppy outside, the puppy will hold it, and then you come inside, let the puppy go, and he runs in the guest room and goes to the bathroom. So I'll do the house training first, and it's really, well, it's easy to describe. You know, it's not so easy to do at 5 o'clock in the morning when you're outside, but the theory is easy anyway. Is, first of all, you're going to have a easily accessible batch of tiny little tasty treats. And make them healthy treats, because if you have a 9-week-old little tiny dog, she's going to need to go to the bathroom a lot.
Right, yeah.
So you're going to give her a lot of these. So if you're feeding her a really high-quality kibble and she loves it, you can use that rather than give it to her as part of her morning or evening meal. So you're going to have these little treats. You're going to take her out more than you can imagine possible. You're going to take her out every 15 minutes during the times when puppies particularly need to go, which is early in the morning and in the evening. Take her to where she has been before, where that scent is, and because that scent is the trigger for her to know right. This is the restroom area. And as she's sniffing around, you're going to say some cue. I say, hurry up, because that's how I feel at night in winter in Wisconsin. But, you know, you go pee, you know, do your business, hurry up, say whatever you want to say, but be consistent. And then wait for her to squat and go or eliminate in either way. And then as soon as she's done, you're going to say, good girl, and you're going to give her the treat. And the treat is the trick. A lot of people say good girl and leave it at that. Or they stay at the house and let the dog trot back to them and give them the treat at the back door. That's giving her a treat for coming to the house. You need to give her the treat right where she was when she lifted her little butt off the ground.
Okay.
And you're going to take her out as often as you can imagine. And you also want to feed her on a consistent schedule, because that's going to help her regulate her bowels. So in terms of house training, if she eats sort of all throughout the day, you're never going to be able to predict when. And she's not going to be able to predict when she needs to go. So that's the house training. And one thing to keep in mind is that the smaller the dog, the longer it takes to house train them. I think it's because their metabolism is so high, the smaller animal gets, the higher their metabolism tends to be. At least you don't have a hummingbird. But you've got you've got a little jackrat, and they're little tiny things. So you need to take her out a lot. And besides that, she's a girl, you know, and we're always in the restroom. So that's just that's just what it is. So in terms of crate training, and I'm glad you're asking, because it can be such a good thing to teach an animal to do. It can make everybody's life so much nicer.
Right.
The best way to do it is to not just sort of shove her into a crate and shut the door, but first, the first couple of sessions, you're just going to throw a treat in the crate and let her walk in herself. And if she's a little shy, just put the treat right on the lip of the crate or right in front of the crate. Get her moving towards it and then eventually into it by this sort of progressive tossing of treats until she's happy to leap in the crate, get her treat, and then she comes right out again. Do that 10, 15 times in a row, and that was one session. Ooh, that was fun. And then after a couple of days, then you're going to start, when she jumps into the crate and gets the treat, you're going to shut the door just for a second, just 1/1000th, then you're going to open it and let her out. And then it's going to be 2 1/1000ths, and then 3 1/1000ths. And then what you also want to do is when she's, you know how puppies are, they have off-on switches? They're just like, I'm asleep, I'm awake, yeah. I'm asleep, right? So when she's about to go into, I'm asleep, you're going to put her in her crate. Make it cozy and comfy, not too hot. A lot of people put soft, warm things in there because they think that's what dogs want. Dogs want to be not hot. So make sure that the temperature is right, that she's comfortable. Put the crate in a room. Best is put the crate in the bedroom. Okay. Put it where you're going to be. And then try and take her out as often as you can before she wakes herself up.
And good luck to you.
Good luck. Send us a picture.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. 1-800-462-7413, our number to call. Coming up next, we'll find out what can happen if Nemo and friends end up in the wrong habitat. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets.
Major support for Calling All Pets comes from Dog Tired, the home of American-made premium dog beds, featuring a build-a-bed option where customers choose shapes, fill, size, and fabric options. Designed and tested for man's best friend in Black Earth, Wisconsin. Dog Tired. Information at dawg-tired.com.
I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Time for this week's topic, and Tricia, it turns out more exotic fish are being found off the coast of the U.S., but that's not necessarily a good thing. Is that correct?
It's not. It's not.
I didn't think so.
Researcher Bryce Simmons, who's a PhD candidate at the University of Washington, has found a surprising number of exotic aquarium fish off the coast of East Florida.
Now, what kind of fish are they finding?
Some of these are gorgeous fish. But they're from the tropics. They're from the reef fish, from the Red Sea, from the tropical Western Pacific. Fish like the Moorish idol, which I've seen on the Great Barrier Reef. Stunningly beautiful Arabian angel fish. Beautiful, beautiful fish.
What in the world are Arabian fish doing over here near Florida?
No, that's
a very good question.
That is indeed the question. And, you know, it used to be thought that exotic species like these were entering U.S. waters through the ballast tanks of ocean-going freighters. But Simmons and colleagues looked at this more carefully, and what they found was that the fish that they were finding were the same kind of fish being purchased by aquarium owners in local pet stores. So the belief is that either pet fish owners or individuals in the aquarium fish trade have been releasing these fish into the wild, either to get rid of them or to free them, sort of Nemo style.
And there are some things wrong with that.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of things wrong with that. These are non-native species. And as non-natives, they can wreak havoc on native ecosystems. You know, we should all know this by now. There's a lot of examples. One famous one in marine ecosystems is an algae that was inadvertently released from an aquarium, from a private aquarium, into the Mediterranean. And it took over miles and miles of this coastal ecosystem. And it used to be... It was this beautiful, rich, biotic community of fish and coral, and now it's this barren wasteland of this ugly algae that's just taken over.
That is too bad. And I suppose you never know which species are going to cause the problems when you move them from, you know, one place to another.
Exactly. Exactly. You don't know which species is going to cause trouble. As a matter of fact, the author of the study, along with a group called Reef.
Reef. I like that.
Obviously enough, I guess, it's the Reef Environmental Education Foundation. They talk about releasing these non-native animals, as this fish in this case, as playing Russian roulette. And I think that's a great analogy. So without question, the best thing is to, one, buy your exotic fish very carefully. Be sure you know the source. And second of all, if you do buy aquarium fish, keep Nemo in the tank. No freeing Nemo.
No freeing Nemo. Okay. And if you want to learn more about the Reef Environmental Education Foundation, please visit our website at callingallpets.org. And if you have a question for us you'd like to talk to us right now, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Kelly.
Hi, Kelly. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Anchorage, Alaska.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you from Anchorage, Alaska. And what can we do for you?
Well, I had a question about my cat. She's a tortie, and she's about 10 years old. And she got into this strange habit, and I couldn't figure out how to kind of like redirect, as you would say, not break, but redirect.
Yeah.
She wakes us up in the middle of the night, just when she decides I need to see someone. But it's consistently the same time, like 2 a.m. for a stretch of days, 3 a.m., you know, and she comes in and she makes these cute little monkey noises. She's like, oh, ah.
That's very good.
You know, it's so cute. But, I mean, it's really annoying because it wakes you up, and all she wants to do is just to be with her. She doesn't want out. She doesn't want to be fed. She just wants you to be up. So we'll shut the door. You know, and then she'll just continue to do it at the door. You know how relentless they are.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I started scooping her up like, okay. I scoop her up and I started putting her, and just recently doing this, in the, like the laundry room. And that's where her cat box is.
Okay.
And it's a bigger room and it's come off the garage, so it's not like horrible in there.
Yeah.
But it's like, okay, if you're going to make this noise, we're going to put you in here. But she's not getting it. She did it this morning. I mean, 2 a.m.
Well, there are a couple of things that could be going on, and it's sort of a vast range of possibilities.
She's been doing it for a long time.
Oh, has she?
And I think I encouraged this bad behavior because when she would do it, I'm like, okay, you're out. And I let her outside, and she just wants to sit on the porch or whatever.
And, you know, she might be at the other sort of end of the continuum. based on the kind of vocalizations you're suggesting she's, because she's not making a
affiliative. What is this? Ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ah.
Ting, walla, walla, bang, bang. Come on, Larry.
She's on to something.
Oh, Larry's
age. She heard that old song.
Her age is showing, Miller. I love it. But your monkey-like sounds sounded more like the kind of sounds that cats give when they're seeing prey they can't get at.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so
yes,
if she wanted to go out on the porch, if you would get up and let her out on the porch, it might be like, I want to go hunting now. It's 2 a.m. I'm a cat. Did you read the books? We're nocturnal.
Yeah.
You know? So it well might be that she just wants to go out hunting. So a couple of possibilities. One is to get her much busier during the day playing sort of predatory-like behavior, which, you know, cats and play and predation all go together. You can't separate them out. So lots more playing during the day. Tire her out. Get her feeling like she has something to hunt, even though it's a little stuffed feather on a stick or something.
Yeah.
Increase that. Tire her out a little more. You could try putting the feel away, the plug-in pheromone, to see if that might relax her a little bit. My guess is that there's an animal showing up, and I don't know where you live, but the
thing, but there might be. There's birds all over. And stuff.
Well, and you know, the nightlife in, we even had a guest who talked about in a suburban environment, she sat up at night, and the number of animals that come out at night are astounding. Just an astounding number of animals from.
Well, the kids are out of the way.
right. Well, and it's safer if you're a little tiny mammal, you know, and the tree squirrels and the voles and the mice and everybody's out. So she might literally be saying, I want to go out and go on the porch.
Mm-hmm.
But you could also, you could make a cozy, wonderful bed for her. You shut her into that room. She has a nice, cozy, warm place to sleep. She's cozy. She's got her litter box. She's perfectly happy. And you're several rooms away where you can't hear her making that little noise.
Mm-hmm. That's okay to do. I thought maybe I'd like hurt her spirit or...
You know, I think it's okay. I think one of the wonderful things about our pets like dogs and cats is they're so much more matter of fact than we are. And because they don't have those complicated cortexes where they're not always trying to rationalize and figure out everything, I think they tend to be like, oh, rules changed. You know, oh well.
Okay. So I don't feel so bad about it. I was feeling really guilty about doing that, thinking this like redirection that you speak of. And I thought, you know, I don't know, locking her in the laundry room, I don't know.
as long as it's a room where you feel like she likes to go on her own, it's comfortable, then give it a try. Or find another area of the house.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Give it a shot.
That is great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kelly.
I'm just, Angie, you could get a little nighttime video game thing, Larry. You know, you have a little video game going and puts it in the den where she wouldn't hear it. Keep that cat busy somehow.
Thanks again for calling. Here's the number for you to call, 1-800-462-7413. Give us a call. Trish, do you remember when we talked to Peter in Jupiter, Florida a few weeks ago about the cardinal that kept pecking at his window?
Oh, that's a common phone call, yes.
Well, we heard from Janet from Palm Beach City, Florida, and she had a recommendation for Peter, and this is what she had to say. I was recently in Arusha, Tanzania, and a bird kept waking us up every morning by pecking on the window. So we put magazine pictures of people in the windows, and the bird quit pecking. And actually, she says, Oprah was the most effective, but let's not tell her that.
We'll keep your secret. We'll keep the secret about... That's really funny. That's fascinating. And you know what that makes me wonder about, Larry, is it possible that birds could perceive a photograph of a person as a representation of a person? Now, it's doubtful because when hunter-gatherer societies who were completely non-industrialized were first shown photographs of people, they had no idea what they were. They did not. You have to learn to recognize a photograph as a person, as a human. So if humans can't do it without training, I'm guessing... But surely something about it worked, and so we don't care what, right?
Well, it might have been just putting the something in the window cut the glare. And it might have been the bird was pecking at the window because of the glare.
Well, that's as we all know, that's why birds usually peck at the windows. They see themselves and they're attacking what they think is a territorial intruder. So, yeah, cutting the glare. Oh, you know, if it's a photograph with two big eyes in it, birds do respond to two round black circles as if they were threatening eyes. Could look like an owl or something like that. So that's another possibility. So I think people should experiment and send us their data.
And how do they send the data?
Oh, send us an email. We would love to hear from you. Send it to pettips@wpr.org.
pets@wpr.org. And if you want to call, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Carrie.
And where are you from, Carrie?
Bend, Oregon.
Bend, Oregon. Okay, thanks for calling. And what can we do for you?
Well, I have a corgi who is a little over a year old, male, and he goes nuts, absolutely nuts, if I operate any kitchen appliance. If I bring the broom out, he attacks it.
Oh.
If I open the dishwasher door, he goes on this barking tirade. If he sees the brush, my hairbrush, he goes ballistic.
Whoa.
I have to put him in the garage to grind coffee beans or use the blender, use the vacuum, or even take out the ironing board.
This sounds like life is a little complicated at your house right now. How old
is... It is. And even certain words will just send this dog into orbit.
How old is your corgi?
He's a year.
How long has he been doing this?
A long time. I'd say since he was probably 4 months old.
What do you do now when he starts to bark?
Right now, if it's a major appliance or if I have to brush my hair or sweep, he goes into the garage.
Okay. And that's, I would keep that up for now while you're working on these other issues. But what I would start doing is I would start setting up training sessions where you give him an incompatible behavior. So get a hollow toy. This is the easiest way to do it. Get a hollow toy. Put some great food in it that he absolutely adores. Smear some, ground up chicken or peanut butter or something inside this hollow toy. Show it to him. Wait till you're sure he's really engaged in it. And then put it down. And then pick up your brush and brush your hair one stroke. Honest to goodness. And then put the brush down and take the toy away.
Okay.
Repeat 10 times.
Okay.
And then the next session, you're going to brush your hair twice. When you really have to brush your hair...
Repeat 10 times.
You're going to put it right. But when you really have to brush your hair, you're going to put them in the garage, but you're going to work your way up over a period of, I would say, maybe 6 months.
Okay.
And don't hesitate to link up with a professional trainer. Somebody who's certified would be particularly good, from APDT, who's a CPDT, a certified pet dog trainer, or a certified applied animal behaviorist would be a great idea.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much for calling.
Oh, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate your call. And here's the number for you to call if you want to join in, 1-800-462-7413. Coming up next, we'll talk to an author about how autism helped her understand the minds of animals. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Even man's best friend has a fault or two, so bring out the best in your pet with advice from Patricia's dog training books. Whether you need help with a multi-dog household or you're feeling guilty about leaving your pet home alone, you can find the information you need online. For a selection of books and training guides available for purchase, call the radio store at 800-747-7444 or log on to our website, callingallpets.org.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week, we welcome Temple Grandin to the program. Temple is a professor at Colorado State University and the author of the book Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. And a pleasure to have her with us. Temple Grandin, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Thank you very much. You have autism. How does autism help you understand animals better than someone who doesn't have autism?
Well, I think in pictures rather than language. And thinking in pictures is a continuum. I mean, there's a lot of artists and other people that also can think in pictures. But to understand animals, you need to get away from language. A lot of people mainly think in words. And when I think in pictures, my mind sort of was like Google for images. You know, you put in a keyword like, you know, teacup, and I start to get lots of pictures flashing up in my mind of different teacups. And then an animal can form a concept by putting, you know, pictures of certain types of people are bad. Okay, men with beards are bad. You know, ladies and men with no beards are good. You see, it's visual. It's visual categorization. And when I was real young, I didn't know that other people didn't think in pictures. I thought everybody thought in pictures.
There's an aspect of thinking in pictures and seeing the world so visually that, that I think is so important for everybody who loves animals to know, which is the focus of animals on details. Would you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yes. In my work with cattle back in the 70s, when I first got started, we're putting cattle through the vaccinating chute. And in some places, the cattle went through really well. Other places, they didn't. Okay, what was the problem? Okay, one place, there may have been reflection on water. There may have been a coat hung over the fence. There may have been metal that jiggled. Or they could see people up ahead. And, you know, people thought it was kind of crazy to get in the chute to see what cattle were seeing. But it's details. You know, when you're trying to solve problems with animals, you've got to, it's details rather than not in details.
Well, what did you find in that situation with the animals in the feedlots and or the vaccination sheds?
Well, I found things like one particular chute faced right into the morning sun. And animals have a tendency to go from a dark place to a bright place, but they're not going to go into blinding light. They go into blinding light, they don't like that. It's like driving into the sun. So one handling facility worked really badly because it faced into the sun, and one that had the same design that did not face into the sun worked fine. And I was the first person to see that difference.
I know one of the things I'd love for you to talk a little bit about, the radical improvements you've made in welfare that got animals to flow into these facilities smoothly rather than balking and having to be forced in a state of fear.
Well, one of the things is getting rid of all the things they're afraid of. You know, people used to say, well, cattle know they're at a slaughterhouse. I found their behavior was the same at a well-run slaughterhouse as it is going up the vaccinating chute, you know, out at the feed yard or out on the ranch. And you get rid of those things they're afraid of, air blowing in their face, reflections on water, shiny metal that jiggles, seeing people up ahead, put up some shields so they don't see people. I was just out at a plant yesterday, and they couldn't get their cattle to go into the restrainer. And I said, get me one of those trouble lights, you know, that's just on a cord. And I held the trouble light up over the restrainer entrance to give indirect lighting, and they walked right on in.
Yeah.
You know, they had done some experimentation with lighting, but they just hadn't put the lights in the right place.
Is that a skill? What are the skills that animals and maybe autistic people share?
Well, it's mainly not thinking in language. Now, I find in dealing with people that think more in language, I have to give them checklists of things to do. Like at this plant that I went to yesterday, I have a whole lot of little changes I'm doing on it. Their conveyor speeds were wrong. We have to get some lights put in the right place. There was a metal shield that blocks their vision that touched their backs. We got to raise that up. But the people at the plant kind of have a tendency to want to tear the whole system up. I go, wait a minute. We got about 8 details here we need to fix, and then I think this system's going to work fine. You don't need to tear anything up. But there's a tendency lots of times that people want to do the big thing rather than fixing the whole lot of little things that can really add up to the big thing.
That's very American. Not just human, but also very American.
Yeah, and the other thing you've got to realize, animals also have instinctual, you know, hardwired behavior patterns.
Sure.
You know, that are unique to each species, and you have to take those things into account, too.
Well, you know, speaking of innate predispositions, I'd love you to talk a little bit about emotions and compare the emotions of animals and people. You have a lot to say about that in your book, and I'd love to hear you talk some more about it now.
Animals definitely have emotions, and when people challenge me on that, I go, wait a minute, they got all the same neurotransmitters that we have, things like serotonin and norepinephrine, the same neurotransmitters, and psychiatric drugs like amphetamines or Prozac have the same effect on animals. So you've got to have some of the same circuits there. One of the things we need to be looking at is we need to be careful not to create fear memories in animals. And you can get a fear. I knew a horse that was afraid of black hats because he'd been abused by somebody wearing a black cowboy hat. And whenever he saw black hats, he got scared. Because why do animals have fear? Fear is the motivation that motivates an animal to stay away from predators. You know, if you weren't afraid of a lion, you're going to just get eaten up by a lion. And I can really relate to fear because in autism, my primary emotion is fear. You know, I get really scared of, you know, physical danger gets me really scared. You know, I've got emotions, but they're simpler and they're more in the present. You know how a dog can be growling 1 minute, wagging his tail the next?
Right.
It's much more in the present. I don't have a brooding, seething emotions.
And pain was interesting to me in your discussion of pain. You also talked about pain and fish in your book and some of the research that was done on that.
Now, the pain thing, you know, when people ask me all the time about animal emotion, and I just tell them about the neurotransmitters and the psychiatric drugs. But when it but the experiments that I tell them about when they question pain, I tell them about two self-medication experiments where the knee joints of chickens and rats were artificially, they created arthritis by injecting very bad stuff into the knee joint. And then they gave them two waterers or two feeders, one that contains a very powerful opiate-based painkiller that tastes awful, and one that has either plain feed or water. And when the leg is all sore and arthritic, they drink the painkiller, and then as the leg heals, they switch over to plain water. That's a self-medication experiment, and that's been done in the chicken and the rat, and go into that in detail in the book. And as far as I'm concerned, that's absolutely the gold standard. I mean, we can definitely say, you know, birds and mammals definitely feel pain and they'll self-medicate. The fish, we need to do the self-medication experiment. They definitely feel fear. I think that's really clear, but you've got to separate fear from pain. There was an experiment done where acid was injected into the lip of a fish and he rubbed around on the floor of the aquarium. You know, what is he experiencing? We need to figure out a way to do the self-medication experiment in fish because that's the real big gold standard.
How do we begin to understand animals the way you do? Is it possible for people who aren't autistic?
Well, let's give you some exercises. Why don't you go play with Google for images? You know, just think up a word like, you know, pink elephants. In fact, I Googled that one time.
Okay.
And you type that in and I even typed in pink and green elephants. And when I typed in pink, green, and blue elephants, I don't think I got anything. But, you know, but my mind works just like that. Okay, if you type in pink elephants, okay, the first picture I got in my mind was at the Phoenix Zoo. We were having taken one of the elephants there and painting her pink. So now I'm thinking about how are we going to get her painted pink. And then we got to make sure we paint her with something that isn't going to make her sick or poison her. And then I'm seeing, I now just got off the subject of a white elephant I painted on a store for a gift shop, selling white elephants. I'm now seeing a thing on TV with a matriarch elephant, you know, with the herd. You know, but I can get off the subject. I mean, I got from pink elephants to white elephants at a gift shop.
Gotcha.
And now I'm seeing myself and my aunt's ranch making this sign for this. It was actually a secondhand shop. And you'll also see how Google gets off the subject the same way. It's associative thinking, but it does have a kind of logic.
Right, and it sort of follows a train. Whereas if you say pink elephant, to me, I just see a visual image of a pink elephant, and that's it.
Most people just get the generic image,
right.
Which means that in your brain, you're going down into the association cortex, but you're not getting inside the file folders. In your brain, you're looking at the title of the file folder, but you're not getting into the pink elephant file folder. And brains actually set up file folders with distinct boundaries. And in fact, I've reviewed some of that research in when I updated my other book, Thinking in Pictures.
Well, it's a fascinating topic, Temple, and
we could talk all day.
Thank
you. I'd love to talk all day.
We would love to, too.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Temple Grandin is the author of Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. She spoke to us from her home in Fort Collins, Colorado. Don't go away. Our animal trivia question of the week is coming up next with your chance to win a copy of Temple Grandin's book. And we'll take more of your calls. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell. This is Calling All Pets.
Major support for Calling All Pets comes from Dog Tired, the home of American-made premium dog beds, featuring a build-a-bed option where customers choose shapes, fill, size, and fabric options. Designed and tested for man's best friend in Black Earth, Wisconsin. Dog Tired. Information at dawg-tired.com.
This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. Now, if you think you know the answer to this week's question, call us at 1-800-462-7413. Or you can also send us an email to pets@wpr.org. And I suspect we'll have several correct answers, and all correct guessers will have their names pulled together, and the winner will be selected at random. Here's this week's question. A dog named Barney recently made headlines when he chewed up a number of valuable teddy bears. One of these unfortunate teddy bears was made in 1909 by the German manufacturer Steiff, and later it belonged to a legendary singer. Who was that legendary singer? Now, if you think you know the answer, call us at 1-800-462-7413, or you can send us an email. Send that to pets@wpr.org. And this week's winner will receive a copy of Temple Grandin's book, Animals in Translation. And check our website in about a week to find out the answer. That's callingallpets.org. And again, if you'd like to talk to us right now, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Vanessa in Boonville, Arkansas.
Well, Vanessa, thank you so much for calling. What's your question?
Well, I have a rodent question. I have a son, Alex, who has a pet rat, and I have a son, Jeff, who has a pet gerbil.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, and they each just have the one, and knowing that they're kind of social animals, they wanted to let them become playmates.
Mm.
But we weren't sure if it was a good idea to put them in a cage together, or if they would play together, would it be better to have a third kind of play area, or was this a disaster waiting to happen?
Well, it's a very good question. You know, there's not a lot of research on interspecific interactions between rodentias species. I haven't read any reprints on that lately. But here are the important things to look at is first of all, is what are the sexes? If they are, even if they're different species, it still might be helpful if one's a male and one's a female. Do we know the sexes of these individuals? I'm sure you do the rat.
The rat is a girl.
Okay.
And I think the gerbil is a male.
Well, that might be good. A little harder to tell with gerbils than it is with rats, for those of you without gerbils. One thing you might want to do, I do like your idea of introducing them in an area that's not on territory. I think that's a very good idea. What you might want to do is introduce them in such a way where there's a screen between them. They can smell each other. Smell is extremely important to these species. And they can sniff each other, but they can't get at each other. So don't make it a screen where they can get their little teeth through and bite each other. Make it a screen that has, you know, like a screen you'd put on your window that doesn't allow insects in. Mm-hmm. Make it a screen that they can't actually do any harm to each other through, but let them sniff each other and see how they behave.
Okay.
Rats, as you are absolutely right, rats particularly are highly social. Gerbils' social system, I'm not an expert in it, but it's a little more complicated, but it's possible that these individuals will get along very well. Do keep in mind that with the rat particularly, they are highly social, but if the rat gets a lot of interaction with your son Alex, that's a lot of social interaction. So it partly depends a little bit on how much time individuals and families spend with each of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the rat is very handled and rides around in his pocket,
things like that.
So he does socialize. The gerbil's not as friendly.
They're not. They don't have the same kind of social. They're sort of more loners a little bit. They don't have the same kind of social system. So my guess is if anybody is going to say, I want to be alone, it's going to be the gerbil. Age also makes a difference. Younger animals, as we all know, tend to be more sort of open-minded and more playful. So if you've had these animals for a long time and the gerbil is an adult, which doesn't take a long time to become an adult gerbil, then that might make it a little more difficult as well. But so, you know, it's also entertaining for the family to watch two animals play together.
Oh, yeah.
But go very slowly because things could go very bad very fast.
They have sharp teeth.
They have very sharp teeth, and you don't want to have to go to the exotic animal veterinarian.
Thanks for calling, Vanessa.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call very much. 1-800-462-7413, our number if you want to join in. Tricia, we received an email from a listener named Terry, and she wants to know what your thoughts are about the Kohler or Kaler, I'm not sure which, training method for dogs. I'm not sure if it's pronounced Kohler or Kaler.
You know, I'm not even either, but it's spelled K-O-E-H-L-E-R.
That's correct.
And it's, you know, it's a very... Boy, it's sort of a blast from the past to hear about that because you don't hear about it very much anymore. It's a very, I would call it an old-fashioned kind of method in that it's force-based. It uses a lot of positive punishment. So a lot of people, all of the certified applied animal behaviorists I know, don't advise those kind of methods. And, you know, it's sort of interesting because there's been a renewed interest lately in using force, particularly in relation to getting dominance over your dogs lately, sort of around the country. And it's unfortunate because using punishment or some kind of force so often elicits defensive aggression from dogs. We've actually had several clients call the office just in the last month who said they were using sort of a force-based hold your dog down on the ground and get dominance over them kind of method, and they got bitten. And these are dogs who would not have bitten otherwise.
So you're getting more business as a result of this, but not the kind you want.
It's not the kind I want. And ironically, you know, when I started Dog's Best Friend, 18 years ago, this was a very common technique, and there's been a wonderful, beautiful integration of the science of influencing behavior and Skinner's work and operant conditioning and marine mammal training using lots of positive reinforcement, not spoiling animals. You know, we don't want spoiled animals who just get cookies for just looking cute all the time and basically run the household. But just like you train your children that there are boundaries and they need to get what they want by being patient and polite, but you use positive reinforcement and role model being positive and gentle and kind. I think we need to do the same thing with our animals. And Kohler's methods are sort of let the dog correct themselves, correct the dog. There's a lot of force. There's a lot of punishment oriented. So I do not recommend it.
So for Terry, you would suggest to her that she would not sign her 6-month-old golden retriever puppy for that training program.
Is that what she's asking?
Yes.
Well, I personally wouldn't. No, I wouldn't. There's so many other new training programs out in the country now that use a lot more positive reinforcement and are much more effective and don't send clients to people like me. We don't want more clients. We've
like
got
that.
More than we can handle.
Right. Right. And if you have an email question, we'd sure love to hear from you. And you can email us at pets@wpr.org. And if you want a phone, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, how are you?
Well, just great. Who are we speaking with?
This is Melissa calling from Queens, New York.
Melissa, pleasure to speak with you. What can we do for you?
Recently, about a month and a half ago, I adopted an adult cat from a shelter. And she's wonderful. Her name is Jasmine, and she's great. She's very well behaved. My problem with Jasmine is at night, she wants to sleep on me, on my back, on my face, on my head, just all over. I mean, and it's just, and it's a problem, and I feel terrible because, you know, I know that if I roll over, I might hurt her or push her off the bed, and she insists on doing it, and I can't not let her in the room because she did this pathetic meow.
You can't sleep to that?
I know, and it's a it's a problem. I don't know what to do about it. And I love her. I want to figure out a way to let her know that it's okay to sleep on the bed, but she can't sleep on my face.
I'll tell you what I would try first.
Okay.
I go to it first because it's relatively easy, and I did it with one of my cats.
Okay.
And it worked, although it took about 3 months.
Okay, that's fine.
Not speedy, but this is the keep the cat in the bedroom with you rather than shutting them out of the bedroom. So this is the keep the cat in the bedroom method. And basically, it does mean you're still going to be somewhat sleep deprived.
Okay.
Because for a while.
What you need to do is create a situation where it's almost digital. There's like a yes, no. You know, if she does one thing, A happens. If she does something else, B happens. So if she's sleeping anywhere below, say, your waist,
okay,
then she can get pets, she gets cuddles, she gets to sleep there, she gets warm and cozy. Anytime she creeps up, all you're going to do is you're going to rapidly but gently push her down. Every time she does. And that's the hard part, is because you want to sleep.
Right.
And, you know, what happens is that you sort of start going to sleep, and then she starts crawling up, and then you wake up, and she's lying draped over your face.
Exactly. That's exactly what happens.
So what you want to do is, whenever you possibly can, is stay alert. So when she starts to creep up, you just push her down. And you're going to try and use not your hands. Try and use your arm, sort of your elbow, your shoulder. Try and unch her back without pushing with your hands. Dogs and cats particularly seem to react differently. They can get sort of snippy. Dogs think you're playing. Sometimes cats think you're playing.
If you use your hands.
One thing I did with this kitty, who was particularly bad, sounds like yours, she'd drape on your mouth. But whenever she would get right around my head, I would just sort of bolt up in bed. I would just sit up as fast as I can.
Okay.
And so she sort of tumbled, you know,
yeah.
And down. And she didn't think that was particularly fun. And I didn't say anything to her. So basically, your attitude is, this has nothing to do with me. This is just, you do A happens. You do B, B happens. It's just, that's what it is. It's just, there are consequences to what you do, and I have no control over them. You are just a helpless victim lying in bed. So try that. And take 2 aspirin and call us. Let us know how that goes.
Thank you so very much.
Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Patricia, I appreciate all your great answers this week. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, it's always my pleasure to be here.
And we'll do it again next week.
Well, I hope so. I'll be here. So you better be here, Mueller.
I sure will. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she is here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster, and Brad Colbert is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. Kate Hewson designed our website. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for Calling All Pets.
For a copy of today's show, call the Radio Store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0519P and bring out the best in your pet with advice from Tricia's dog training books. If you need help training your new dog, or if you're feeling guilty about leaving your pet home alone, information is available online. Visit our website at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.